Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from the ISF podcast. Again, thank you very much for tuning in and listening. First off, I'd like to, as always, introduce my co-host and my producer, and that would be Rachel. Rachel, say hello.
Rachel, who is not torturing children in the background, I promise you, is here. Hello, Rachel.
There you go. There you go. And tonight, we're very pleased to have back one of the great micro-budget directors and someone who I think has one of the best senses of humor I have ever seen in film. We'd like to welcome back Mark Pirro. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Hello, Carl. I'm as good as I can possibly be at this point in time.
Well, I would think you're pretty good because you've got something happening, what, 2 days from now?
That's right.
So tell us about it.
Well, it's my 11th feature film, and it's called The Deceased Won't Desist. And it's about a deceased guy who invites a bunch of people up to his cabin to find out what they all get. And he has a series of videos that he has prepared before he died to be played at various times throughout the weekend. And as each one of them finds out something about themselves or the others, one by one, they start dying. And then, of course, he comes back with another video talking about what just happened. So it poses the question to the people that are up there, is he really dead? Is he arranged, or has he arranged something with somebody, or what the hell's going on here? They have no idea. But that's basically the premise.
So how many Agatha Christie novels did you read when you were young?
I didn't read any of them. I'm not a big reading fan. I like, but I would say this probably, well, yeah, this definitely follows the pattern of the 10 Little Indians or Then There Were None, that sort of thing. But it's got a little bit of, I guess you'd call it the Pirro slant, because the people involved, you've got a series of people. One is a shyster priest. Two of them are abortionists. Another one is a lesbian bartender. Another one is a black filmmaker. So everybody's got their own little personality traits, and everybody has a reason that they were invited to come to this secluded cabin.
I'm digging the weirdo representation there. I mean, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, we got a pretty good representation of all different types of individuals.
So tell us a little bit about the process of this. You started this, I guess, in 2019, right before COVID, correct?
Yeah, COVID was just beginning to show its ugly head when we started this film. And when it got into full swing, we had a few delays because there were a couple of trips that we had to take to a cabin up north about an hour and a half from Los Angeles. And in the process of it, we actually had one actor who decided he didn't want to continue on with the movie. So literally I had to write him out. And it's not the first time that's happened to me, by the way, so I'm kind of used to figuring out how to work around actors when they leave. But he just got, freaked out, and he goes, I don't want to go back up to the cabin. He was up there once with us, and then he goes, I just don't want to go back up there with 10 people, in an enclosed area. So we managed, and then there were some other scenes that we shot. Like we had an older gentleman in the film who plays a priest, and he, he was pretty nervous about being around people too. So we kind of worked around him where we had a dialogue scene between him and another actress, and we just shot all of his side of the scene without anybody else there. And then we shot her side of the scene later and then just kind of edited it together. So we had to make a few compromises and had to jump through a few hoops to get this done, but we finally did. And let's say we're ready to premiere it in 2 days.
Okay, so where is it going to be premiered, and tell us all about that?
Well, it's a theater in Encino. It's called Lemley's Town Center Theater. It's on Ventura Boulevard. I think it's 17200 Ventura Boulevard. And we're going to try and see if we can do this, you know, socially distance as safe as we can. I mean, we figured we're going to tell people that are vaccinated to stay in one side of the theater, and then we're going to have another side mark idiots for the people that are not vaccinated, and we'll put them on that side. But I figured that, you know, we want to be fair, and we said that we'll also, if we can have seats, empty seats between people, we'll do that. But if we fill up by any chance, then that just tells us all that God doesn't give a shit, and, you know, we'll just have to deal with it. But
Can you please promise me you're going to have the idiots section, please?
Well,
I need this to be a real thing.
Yeah, we might be a little more subtle about it, you know, because I told them, I posted on Facebook that we're not going to ask for vaccine identification or anything, but we asked them to, the ones that are not vaccinated, to wear their red MAGA caps so we can at least identify them, you know, but we don't know.
Yeah, if you haven't noticed, I was on your website, and that's, by the way, www.piromount.com, and that's P-I-R-R-O-M-O-U-N-T. And I do notice on the homepage where you get just a bit political here and there.
Once in a while. I don't usually get political. I've never been political before Agent Orange got into the office, and that only kind of put it on the radar for me, because I never paid attention to who was elected, and, you know, the country kind of ran itself. But, the Orange Idiot just kind of got me involved a little bit more, and I would do some, you know, we did a series of videos, parodies, and songs and things like that. You know, sometimes creativity can be motivated by anger or, you know, frustration. And, you know, so, yeah, we did a few political things, but hopefully we'll go back to normal soon, and we'll be able to stop doing that.
Okay, so tell us a little more about the film in terms of, you know, I always ask the budget of you, because I swear to God, you made a movie for $500. And of course,
yeah,
being with ISF, we've talked about this, that you believe that you just go out and do it and that sort of thing. So tell us a little bit more about the technical process of doing the deceased don't desist, which is very hard to say, by the way.
Yeah, I know it is. Deceased won't desist. But you think of the word cease and desist, you know, that's kind of a play on that. I've been making movies for almost 40 years now, and most of them have been in the four-figure range. Occasionally we've gone over, but that's usually when there have been other people that have come in and put money into the film, and it more or less became their film, like Death Row Game Show or Buford's Beach Bunnies. And Deceased Won't Desist is another very low-budget film, probably, let's just say, under four figures. But again, it's sort of like, because of the technology today, and since I have most of it at my disposal, if everybody were to have gotten paid what they deserve, this would have been easily over a $100,000 film. You know, but we've got a lot of talented people that donated their time and talent to the film. We have a great composer who's doing the musical score. He also happened to own the cabin that we shot in, so we got that location. And then I'm friends with Joe Michelli, which is an Italian. He has an Italian restaurant out here in North Hollywood, and he let us use the restaurant for a night. So I'm pretty good at getting locations from people that I know. You know, they've been very supportive over the years. And my cinematographer, his name is Bruce Heinzius, he DP'd my last two films prior to this one. But he goes all the way back to my very first film, Polish Vampire in Burbank. He was like 15 when I met him then, and he's been involved in one way or another in practically every movie I've ever made. So in a sort of roundabout way, I'm probably over answering your question here, but when you've got a team of people that keep coming back again and again, and they'll waive their salary, a friend of mine who does visual effects professionally, he's worked on all of the Sharknado films. That's probably the big claim to fame you may have heard about. But, he will help me with my visual effects on films and again, not charge for it. So we built such a team of people over the years that I've been able to keep the budget down. The biggest expense in this film was literally just buying food for the, when we were up at the cabin, you know, and I reimbursed them for the gas. Those that wanted to drive themselves up to the cabin, you know, I gave them gas money, but that's about it. You know, everything else is, the cameras are not that expensive. Obviously the cards that we put the video on is not expensive. So really, what's the expense nowadays to make an independent film?
Well, and I love that. I love it. You can really tell with a lot of your films that these people are not doing it because they're getting paid to. They're doing it because they want to. They're doing it for the love of the film and the story. And you don't get a lot of that from people in Hollywood anymore. I mean, I totally agree with Scarlett Johansson suing Disney and all that, but still, it's like, I'm still not going to go see the movie. I don't really care about any of this, and I don't feel like she really cares about, you know, the characters and the story of the, you know, Black Widow and all of that. Unlike when you see things like you do, where, you know, we're finding out now that these people actually, you know, did waive their salaries. It's not like you just flat out didn't pay them. You're not some shyster like that priest, apparently, but they're doing it because they want to. And there is such a different feel for movies like that. And I have to say thank you, whatever powers that be out there, for directors and writers, because I've noticed you've written 15 movies that you've also directed. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. But, I mean, a lot of the people that work on my films, I mean, will literally go back 30 or 40 years with me. And some of my friendships are from when I was a tour guide at Universal Studios in the 70s. You know, that's where I met, like, my visual effects friend, whose name happens to be Glenn Campbell. But we were tour guides together at Universal, and he was studying to get into camera work and visual effects, and you know, I went my own way trying to make my own little films. But when you got these people that you've known for years, it sort of becomes a fraternity or a family, you know. And I have some actors that will show up even when we don't need them. You know, if we don't need them on a given day, they'll show up anyway, maybe just to hold a microphone or to move a light or something. So it really is more of a family party kind of an atmosphere. There's no pressure on the sets. There never is. Because, you know, the old saying, time is money. In our case, no, it's not. Time is just time. And, you know, if we make a film that people like, great. If they, you know, if they don't like it, then all right. You know, we wasted a little time, but we had a good time doing it. So money's rarely been a motivating factor for the films I do.
Right.
So that's a question.
Okay, go ahead, Bruce.
That's one I've been wanting to ask a lot of our micro budget guys, and I mean you're one of our best, Mr. Pirro. So I know that money, when you're making these films, is not a motivating factor, but do you actually make any sort of money off of them, like post production?
You mean once the movie's done, does it make money for me?
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah. Some do. Some do, some don't. But the thing is, if you make a movie for $1,000 or less, you know, you sell 100 DVDs and you made your money back. We're thereabouts, you know what I mean?
Right.
So some movies have done better than others. But now, because of the streaming video, the streaming media, it's pretty much guaranteed you're going to get something every few months. Like practically all of my movies are on Tubi right now. And
yes.
You know, we'll get a check every few months, and it's sort of like, okay, that's one outlet. I still sell all of our films through my website and through Amazon and through eBay, you know. So things will always trickle in. It's not certainly enough to go and buy a house in Beverly Hills, but it's enough to sustain. And one keeps an overhead that's not that high. You know, I'm not a big party dude, and I don't have a lot of things that I don't have any overhead really to worry about. So I can keep a lifestyle with the royalties that trickle in over the years, and you know, movies like Polish Vampire still pays off. That movie's almost 40 years old, and I'll still get royalties here and there from it. So
I was going to watch that one today.
And I also, I do odd things too. Like I worked on the last two Sharknado films because my friend who does visual effects sometimes needs extra compositors or, you know, visual effects artists. So when that happens, he'll call me and a couple of other friends, say, can you come in and, you know, do some compositing for us or what have you. And so, you know, I'll come in and do that. And I even tell him I'll do it for nothing, but he goes, no, I'm working for a company that pays, you know, so we'll be glad to pay you to do it. But there was also a time when I used to shoot marketing research focus groups. That was sort of a part-time gig for me, and that brought in an income. So, you know, when you're doing these kind of films here, you can't depend on them to go out and be the brass ring for you, but it's not to say it's not possible. You know, it's not possible. It can happen, but don't count on it.
Well, one of the things that I don't know if our people know is, you know, we were talking about Polish Vampire and Burbank. That particular film was picked up by USA, and you did quite well, at least, you know, as far as the money that came in through that. And over the years, do you feel that your product that you put out has gotten like a cult following and that people know who you are and things like that? Because I can tell you this, as far as ISF, a lot of your things are posted all the time. So, mm-hmm. you know, but that's always a good thing. I mean, that's one of the reasons we do this, is to put a spotlight on filmmakers like you and that do it for the passion. This isn't about the money for you, is it?
Oh, no, but I get emails from people that, you know, said I was 13 when I first saw Polish Vampire on USA Network, or I used to joke about when it first came out on DVD, not DVD, VHS back in those days, and I said most people that found it probably discovered it by accident. You know, they were probably looking for Police Squad, and it was out, or Police Academy, and it was out.
Right.
So they say, oh, here's Polish Vampire. I mean, a lot of people that discover that film kind of discovered it by accident. Other people may have discovered it because once the backstory came out that it was made for practically nothing and that it was out there in the world. And, you know, there were segments done on Entertainment Tonight and Hard Copy, and a lot of these television shows did little pieces on it. So as people discovered the film, and as people discover it today, you know, some of them will be aware of maybe one of my films, and then they'll go on the internet and say, oh my God, you know, he's done a bunch of other films. Let's look at these, you know? So I'll get a email from somebody who might say I discovered Curse of the Queer Wolf and then never realized that it was based on a character from a previous movie, or, you know, more recently, people that discover films that I did more recently had no idea that I started in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. So, It's kind of like a lot of independent filmmakers, you know, you discover, like Ed Wood is a good example. You know, everybody remembers Plan 9 from Outer Space, but nobody knows or nobody knew in the early days that he had made other movies besides Plan 9. You know, that was the one that just got the heat. So with me, it's probably Polish Vampire. It's probably the one I'll be remembered for because it got on USA Network, which gave it national exposure.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I was going to, wave a flag for one of your films, and we talked about this last time, everybody, and I mean everybody, needs to see Rectuma. Seriously.
Yeah.
I freaking love that film.
Well,
that's another one I was going to watch. So mad I didn't.
I would say that's
not
probably,
that I'm not going to.
Well, no, that's probably the funniest movie I will ever make. And it's funny, too, because it's not really a chick flick, but there are people that have coerced their girlfriends into watching it. And then by the end of the film, they say, this is so much fun, you know, because it's not to be taken seriously on any level. And if you go in with that attitude that anything goes, you'll probably have a good time. If you go in with a stuffy attitude, then, you know, as Quentin Tarantino would say, go suck a dick.
See, I totally get it. My taste in movies and me trying to make people watch movies is probably hashtag this is why I'm divorced. So I'm really glad to be a happily single woman because I can watch your movies all I fucking want to.
Well, if you haven't seen Rectuma, if you haven't seen Rectuma, I would say go to Tubi and watch the damn thing.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm going to, like, after we get off the show tonight, I put the kids to bed. It's Rectuma all the way. And just a really quick synopsis for everybody, I have to see this movie because I read the description on Tubi looking for some other stuff by Mr. Pirro. So a guy gets somehow infected by a butt-humping toad in Mexico, and then his ass grows to, like, 20 feet and starts framing him for murders? Am I getting that right?
That's not the best description they could have said, but basically, yeah. I mean, he goes on a Mexican vacation. He goes on a Mexican vacation with his homicidal maniac wife who's been trying to kill him throughout the whole movie. And he falls asleep, gets infected by a Mexican butt-humping bullfrog who basically travels to, you know, Mexico and infects people. And, in fact, he goes to Mexico because his wife doesn't like the L.A. beaches because they're overcrowded with foreigners. So they go to Mexico. He gets infected. And then he starts developing a pain in his butt. He goes to a proctologist to figure out what's going on. And the proctologist says, well, you know, it's a little bit more than I can handle, but there is a Japanese doctor who is good at healing the unhealable, fixing the unfixable, and I suggest you go see him. So he sends them to a specialist, this doctor named Dr. Wansonsaki, and when they get there...
Wansonsaki! Okay, that tells you something. I love your humor. I seriously do.
Wansonsaki treats our hero with a nuclear rod by sticking up his ass. He says that will shrink the hemorrhoids that you have, and the rod breaks in his butt, and then little by little things start going even worse from that point on. So, eventually, but it's done in the kind of classic genre of Godzilla, you know, so it kind of follows that pattern. Right down to the two little Japanese singing fairies that sort of relay the story along as kind of a Greek chorus. And, it's loaded. I mean, it's loaded with a lot of crazy stuff. We premiered it, I think, 13 or 14 years ago. And at that particular screening, I actually recorded the audience. And without exaggerating, not more than a minute goes by without a laugh. I mean, it's that tight of a film. And I say that with all due modesty, but I was a lot younger then, and I had a weirder sense of humor back then, and I think I was a little more abandoned in my comedy. So, you know, things change. As you get older, you get less funny, but we try.
Oh, we are totally here to stroke your ego. You can be as immodest as you want to be. Like, we love you. That's why you're on the show. Duh. So don't be afraid to tell us how awesome you are.
Okay, yeah, damn, I'm the best. No, I know where my place is in filmic society. I mean, in the real world of filmmaking, you know, this doesn't even register on the Richter scale. But as far as independent films go, yeah, I think, you know, we've kind of achieved a certain plateau as far as indies go. And I'm pretty happy with most of the films we've done, you know, because there's some I would love to see remade. Like Nudist Colony of the Dead, which is my least favorite as far as the way it was shot. We used some really crappy equipment. We had the worst lighting. We didn't have a lot to work with on that particular film. But the songs are so cute and so catchy, and the concept behind it is so fun that I would love to see someone like Tim Burton get a hold of it and remake it. I think it would really be like a little Shop of Horrors.
I tell you what, one thing about Nudist Colony and a number of your films, and I have to ask you, do you write the songs or is that your composer? Do you do that in tandem? Because those songs are just amazing.
Well, for that particular film, I used a composer that I had used on all my earlier films, a guy named Gregory Gross. And he, you know, he wrote the underscore for Polish Vampire, Queer Wolf, Death Row Game Show, and all. When it came to Nudist Colony of the Dead, I said, I want to make a musical. So I wrote all the lyrics, and then I turned over the lyrics to him, and just maybe sometimes I would sort of hum what I would like it to sound like, and then he would take it from there. But he pretty much arranged it, you know, arranged all the songs and gave them all of the twang that they had. In fact, we did the show after the movie. We did the show live on stage in the 90s for about 4 months here in Hollywood, and we added 4 new songs that weren't in the movie, and they were just as, you know, up-tempo and just as cute as the rest of them. So now with all the songs, which I think there's like 10 or 11 songs total, again, I'd love to see somebody take that and turn it into a bigger film with better makeup and better dancing and better singing, you know. But to answer your question, that's how it goes. I wrote the lyrics and then turned them over to my composer.
Okay. Now, you know, in talking about Rakuma and talking about these films, I do want to ask, they're not exactly what I would call politically correct. Certainly not Rakuma.
In the slightest.
But the question is, do you get any pushback on those now, or have you adapted a little bit, or you just feel that they're just part of, you know, when you did them?
Well, yeah, I mean, they are what they are. I've never been pressured, or I've never worried about offending. I mean, my idea is I want to make a film that's going to entertain my target audience. And my target audience are, you know, okay, people in straitjackets, or people that really, people that have a good sense of humor. When we did Queer Wolf, I got a little pushback, but it wasn't from gays. It was from people that were offended on behalf of gays. You know, there were a few people that said, how could you do this? Well, that gays loved it. This was a very popular film with the gay community. And it's kind of funny because this was long before transgenders became a thing. You know, nowadays, I don't know if a queer wolf, well, I don't know if a queer wolf would be ridden out of town on a rail at this stage of the game, because it's not a homophobic movie. In fact, depending on what you bring to the table when you watch it, it really is anti-gay. It's about these two macho guys that wouldn't be caught dead in a situation like this that happened to, one becomes a transvestite inadvertently, but it's really the story of the Wolfman retold. And again, it was done tongue in cheek. You know, again, when you got these two queer billies that he has a dream that he gets attacked by these guys from Deliverance, basically. I mean, it's not to be taken seriously on any level. If somebody's going to come along and analyze it like he's being homophobic or he's making fun or whatever, again, it's like a dick. There's in Nudist Colony of the Dead, we had an Asian guy. He was half Asian, half Mexican. I think his name was Juan Tu. And he talked like a dish, and he had this. And some people give me pushback saying that's a racist character, a racist movie. But I often thought, you know, if you do a German accent or a French accent or an Italian accent or an English accent, that's fine. Do an Asian accent and you're suddenly a racist. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't get it. I never did. So, but I never worried about it. When I made The God Complex, I knew I was going to get a pushback from religious people, but they're not the audience. You know, they have no business seeing it. You know, it's like me going into a church and yelling, "Hail Satan." You know, you don't do that. You don't go into that environment and stir it up. I mean, when I make a film, I'm inviting the people that think the way I do to enjoy the process, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. So talking about The God Complex, which is another one of my favorites, talk to us about the submissive Jesus.
Ah, the old submissive Jesus, prayer answering talking head. That was a toy. That was a toy that was made for the movie. God and Jesus, well, the story of The God Complex basically follows the Bible, all right, to a certain degree. But then when we come to contemporary times, God, Jesus, they walk among us, but they kind of have to be incognito. So they work as employees at a metropolitan toy company. And one of the toys that they're making, not to the pleasure of God or Jesus, but they made this toy called the Submissive Jesus Prayer Answering Talking Head. It's a little statue of Jesus' head. And when you twist the crown of thorns, he will scream in pain, and then he'll answer your prayer. So you'll have to say something like, you know, please, Jesus, can you help me win the lottery? And then you twist the crown of thorns, and he'll say something like, I'm just the middleman, or, you know, let me ask my dad, or whatever. He says 100 different things. Now, it was made for the movie, but it got a cute reaction, and people seemed to think it was funny in the movie. And I thought, why not really make a bunch of these and sell them, like merchandising, you know? So obviously you're not going to get McDonald's to tie into it, but if I could make a few of them and sell them through my website or Amazon or wherever. And, you know, so we made 2,500 of them, sold about 860. So I still have a bunch left if anybody wants one.
Yes!
But,
I want one so bad! Oh, my God!
In fact, I'm encouraging people, if they want to become like a submissive Jesus wholesale or retailer, you know, we'll give you a great discount if you buy a bunch of them.
Well, you know what? We might be talking to you in about a couple months. Let's just say that.
Yes, I need submissive Jesus in my life, and I know about 100,000 other people that do. So, oh, wow. That is like the best thing I've ever heard. And to be able to tell people it's from a movie, yeah. Yeah. You're about to get a big hit on your radar, buddy.
Absolutely. And The God Complex, too, is a pretty interesting film. Just to give you an idea, Rachel, about how he approaches this, tell us about the burning bush. Melissa, are you there?
Well.
Did Mark leave us?
I'm not sure. He did say he occasionally has problems with his phone. He might have been raptured. So how about we just talk about the one I watched this afternoon?
Okay, let's do that.
I watched one of his newer films, because a lot of what we've been talking about is his older stuff, you know, his like 70s and 80s career. But what people don't maybe realize is that he's actually been making movies pretty steadily. I watched one day called Celluloid Soul. There we go. I was just about to tell people about Celluloid Soul.
Yeah, funny, we were talking about Jesus heads and then we got cut up.
Yeah.
And it's funny because
raptured.
We call that raptured.
Yeah.
You got raptured talking about submissive Jesus. He was like, I'm going to show you how submissive I am, bitch.
Yep, there you are.
You just got bitch slapped by Jesus.
Tell us about the burning bush and the God Complex. Mark,
wow.
You there?
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, we're here.
Hello. We hear
you.
You
gotta stop talking about Jesus. He's really. Hello. Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. You're real in and out.
Okay. I'm talking about the Jesus thing.
I was asking. We'll try this one more time. Tell us about the burning bush in the God Complex. I guess no one wants to hear about that.
Apparently, the universe is speaking to us right now. We're cursed. Oh, there we go. Ask another question, Carl, a completely different question. What is the opposite question of that you can ask? We're not even going to say the J word anymore, okay?
Okay, talk about the movie you watched, Rachel.
Okay, well, that's what I was doing earlier. As I was telling people, I didn't know if you could hear us or if you got fully raptured or not, but I was telling people that you've actually been pretty steadily making movies, and this was a newer one. This was in 2017, Celluloid Soul.
Which one are we talking about? Celluloid Soul.
Celluloid
Soul. 2017, right. Right.
Yes, and that is the one that I'm rife with dick jokes, and I fucking love it.
I can't think
that's the one I was telling you about before the show.
Right. Yeah, I don't remember too many others, though, but who knows? You know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to remember.
Yes, yes. Well, I thought it was an interesting concept because this, you know, film buff kind of aspiring writer, just real bad shit. Obviously, girlfriend out of the picture. Promise you that's not a spoiler, guys. I promise you. Like, yeah, his girlfriend leaves him. Pretty obvious reasons, I think, to most people, maybe. But he doesn't understand it, and I guess he thinks he's just really some great guy. And he falls in love with a woman that he sees in a movie from the 1930s. And she apparently shows up looking exactly like she did in the movies. And by exactly like she did in the movies, I mean like she did on the 1930s screen.
With all the scratches and everything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She's all scratched up, and she's like that. Really inspired by a gentleman that I know. I know an actor from the 70s, a guy named Ron Harper, who used to be in a lot of television shows. He was in the Planet of the Apes TV show. He was in Garrison's Gorillas. He was in a show with George Burns, Connie Stevens, called Wendy and Me. I mean, he had a career in the 60s and 70s, and very few people know who he is today. So it was kind of an interesting concept where I thought there are these people that kind of had a career at one time or started a career, but maybe didn't quite cross over to the point where everybody knows who they are. And then they're forgotten, you know, after a couple of decades. And that's what kind of inspired me to make the movie about this lady who was, you know, an up-and-coming actress in the 30s, but never really got anywhere, you know. So our hero in the film happens to see a couple of these old movies from the 30s, becomes infatuated with her, and starts doing some Google research to find out who she is or whatever. And then one day gets a call from her, and she happens to still be alive. But, you know, he thinks she's like 98 years old. And when she shows up, she looks like, you know, she did in the movie. And he thinks he's losing his mind. And so do his friends.
Yeah.
But that's kind of...
I mean, she's legit, like, in black and white with the scratches and everything. It's crazy. It's almost like you can see her, like, the film moving.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know the words, but... It was a really interesting concept to me, and I really liked that. And, you know, considering that he's got an alcoholic therapist, I mean, it doesn't exactly bode well for him really trying to figure out if he's losing his mind or not. Because, I mean, she sits there, like, not discreet at all with her little airline bottle. Like, please shut this fucker up, chug, chug.
She was great because, you know, that was comedian Judy Tenuta, who was nice enough to do the role for us. And, you know, I'd known her for a few years before, so she did it as a favor, and that gave the film a little credibility. But yeah, there were all some fun characters. In fact, you may not know, or maybe you do know, the guy that plays the lead, Dennis Kennard, played Jesus in The God Complex. Same actor.
I did know.
You did know.
Should I try one more time, Rachel, or not?
I'm going to give it a fourth time's a charm. If you get raptured again, though, I swear to God, we're cursed, and we're never going to talk about that dude again.
Well, what happened? Did you lose me again?
No, every time we mentioned...
We hope not to lose you again, because I've got to ask you a question. We were talking about the God Complex a while back when you got raptured. I just wanted you to tell us a little bit about the burning bush.
Ah, the burning bush. Well, if you've seen the movie, you know what the burning bush is, which is basically a big flame, a patch of flame that's coming from between the legs of Moses' wife, right? with God's head appearing in the middle of the flame, if I'm not mistaken. So,
how did I know that it was going to go there with you? Like, that just, that is so spot on, Piro, from everything I know
so far,
and everything.
You didn't see the God Complex either?
No, she hasn't.
No,
I'm...
I have not. Carl has seen The God Complex. I did make the mistake of reading some stuff with some spoilers earlier, and I feel kind of bad. Yeah.
Well, that's another one to put on your list.
Absolutely.
Oh, no, it's all on my list right now. Seriously, I've read through all of the descriptions of your work, and I am absolutely fascinated, and I'm a little upset that I'm kind of new to your stuff still. Actually, I think around – it was probably at the very beginning of when I started the podcast. You were a show that I had to miss. I had an emergency, and so Carl had to talk to you all by himself, and I was really remiss about that. But yeah, I'm relatively new to your work, but I remember I was supposed to be on the show with you, so I had already done some research. Carl and I, we usually end up having to bring this up in shows, but there's a considerable age difference between us. I'm 35. So a lot of the older stuff I'm still looking into. I mean, I know a lot of it. I mean, I know all the classics like Wicker Man. I've been watching that since I was a kid. But some of the newer and especially some of the micro-budget stuff until I started getting all of my streaming services a few years ago, I didn't really know a lot of it because, I live in Arkansas. I've been here for 35 years, and I live like smack dab in the middle of Arkansas in a very kind of rural area. So it's not like we get interesting stuff like this very often. So I have been having to do a lot of personal research, we'll call it. It's for science, but I've been doing a whole lot of streaming stuff over the past few years, catching up on everything I've missed.
Working with me, yeah. So that does bring a question that I had. So you had the upcoming premiere of The Deceased Don't Desist, and I actually said it right this time. What are you going to do as far as distribution, and what do you have planned after the premiere?
Well, I've got a couple of guys that run a company called Psycho Entertainment, which pretty much handles all my films now. They are the ones that get it. Get it. What I do. In the older days, we try to get HBO served nowadays.
So we're jumping up and down. We're not catching everything, Mark.
See if I can move somewhere. Maybe I could find.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, I just stood up. See if that helps. So what part did you not get?
Like do the whole thing again.
Okay, I have these two guys that that represent me. They run a company called Cyclone Entertainment. They get it into the streaming markets like Tubi and Amazon and places like that. That's where this will probably go as well. Maybe if they can get it in Netflix, that would sort of be the cream of the crop. But you really don't know. It's always a crapshoot. So that's the plan. Turn it over to them and hope they get it out there.
Okay. So the last time we talked, you were talking about this may be the last film you do, which I think would be a shame. But nonetheless, that's my personal opinion. But do you have any plans for anything else down the line?
No, even a prize fighter at some point needs to know when it's time to get out of the ring. And I'm officially a senior citizen this year. So I think I'm sort of considering to retire. If I ever did another film, it would probably be a work for hire. Like I would work on somebody else's project that they were producing. But for me to go out and organize another one of these dog and pony shows and bring it all together and all that, you need the stamina of a 20 or a 30 year old. And I'm just getting a little too over the hill for that. So. We'll have this one, it'll come out, and then I'll just live off my legacy.
Kevin Smith said the same thing a number of years ago when he made the movie Red State. He said that was his last film. He had done his complete director's arc and all of that. Yeah.
Wow.
We're going to see some more Piro. I feel it in my soul.
Well,
because you write a lot of this too, and I don't think that's an easy bug to quash. It's you You may feel that way right now, but I bet you're going to be bored in a few years, and you're going to be like, you know, I've got this really great idea.
Well, I mean, Kevin Smith, he had a heart attack too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so don't compare me to Kevin Smith. The guy. No, I think, I mean, I'm a fan of the old never say never again concept. I mean, I was a big Sean Connery fan, and when he left James Bond, I was kind of pissed off about it, and then he came back and did one more Bond film, and it was like the worst one, but... I
think he did that on purpose.
Well, yeah, I'm sure the money was good, and you know, maybe he wanted to show off Roger Moore or something. Who knows? But my whole thing is that at this stage of the game, to do something like this, it really requires a good 2 to 3 years of your life, because don't forget, you can't shoot this over a month. You have to shoot it stretched out. You know, everybody has to pretty much be on board, and there's a lot of coordination involved. And even though we got through this one without too many glitches, but it was still a bit of a challenge. And when the fun starts to ebb a little bit, and not to say that this wasn't a fun movie to make, but, you know, it's just something about as you get a little older, you slow down a little bit and you're not quite as energetic. And even if you're shooting around LA without permits, you know, when you're 20, you could run away from the cops a lot faster. Back then it would be, hey, you know, you're just a kid. You don't know any better. But now, oh, you're an adult. You should know better. So it's a little harder to play ignorant if you're shooting illegally on the streets or if you're, you know, doing guerrilla filmmaking. But that's not the reason. I think I'm pretty much burned out. I think it's time to move on. And that doesn't mean that I may not still write. You know, or I may not, you know, I may be involved, as I say, in other people's projects, and, you know, I can still edit other people's projects or help people with their own projects, or maybe teach, you know, like a lot of people do. But as far as doing an official Paramount picture where I'm doing it from beginning to end and devoting 2 to 3 years of my life, I really don't see that happening anymore after this one. So, sorry, guys.
Well, we'll just have to... not hold our breaths on it, but we can still hope. There's always hope.
Well, just buy a bunch of Jesus heads, and then I'll consider it.
Okay.
I will work on that. Now, I just noticed something, because I'm still going through and looking at stuff, but, of course, I was looking at, you know, some of Celluloid Soul earlier. I was looking at the cast, and I noticed that Chris Stahl, the hooker, whore, prostitute, call girl, escort, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's Lee Shapiro? Any relation there?
That, what a coincidence, huh? Yeah, that's right. That's gonna be my niece. That is my niece. My niece Lisa, who very supportive of my work. I mean, she's a big fan too, and you know, she's a singer and an actress in her own right. And she has her own YouTube channel where she does interviews as the roving reporter. So I don't remember.
Oh, nice.
Well, actually, I do. We had an actress that was going to play that character. It was actually Gloria Hendry, who was once a Bond girl, and she was willing to do the part. It was a really quick day, you know, and then she canceled the day of the shoot, literally. So I had to work around her, but then my niece happened to be in town and said, you know, why don't you let me do it? And I said, why not? So we let her do it. And that was her, but she's helped out with other films. Like she did some voiceover work, I think, in Rage of Innocence for me. And she was, you know, she'd hold the slate if she was in town for other movies. And so she's kind of been behind the scenes helping here and there. But yeah, that was the first time I actually used her in a project, and she was great.
It was a somewhat brief scene, but it was absolutely hilarious. So you can tell her that she was hilarious as a hooker. I'm just going to think of her forever as the hilarious hooker now.
She'll be happy to hear that.
Final thing is, you look now that you feel that you're going to hang up the hat. So feel about the legacy and the films that you've left us, because to be very honest, for those of us at ISF and those of us that love odd cinema, you have made quite an impression on many of us. And I just wanted you to know that. I just wanted to know how you feel about it.
Well, I'm flattered. I mean, anytime I hear that somebody gets something out of my projects or they, you know, enjoy themselves or like what we do, that's always a nice feeling, you know, because when you make a movie, you don't want to make it for something that's only going to be shown in your garage with your family and friends, you know. So if you can get a project out there and people can see it and appreciate it, I find it very flattering. And, you know, and I'm glad I've got enough projects out there, you know, after 11 features and a couple of shorts. And I think what we got, you know, I have two shorts, I think, that are on one of the DVDs. There's plenty of time people can sit and watch them all, and you can have a couple of days worth of entertainment. But you know, look at Quentin Tarantino plans to quit after 10 movies, so I got 11. I win.
There you go. Right. And I must say that the first movie I ever saw of yours was, and I've told you this before, was Death Row Game Show, and I saw it on HBO, and immediately after watching it, it's like, who the hell directed that? I got to follow this man. And I really do believe, if I take a look at your films, that you're almost like the micro-budget Ritz Brothers in a lot of ways to me. The way that your films go, and sort of that hell's a poppin', who cares what happens attitude in all your films. And I love it. And it's not politically correct, and it's wonderful. I wanted you to know how much over the years that I've really appreciated your work, Mark.
Well, I'm honored and flattered, and you are the reason I make them. You know, you're the target audience, somebody that gets it. You know, I mean, I know there are some people out there that absolutely despise the kind of films I make. And sometimes you look at these people and you kind of go, well, why are you going to see these? Well, you know, if you're going to go see a movie called Wreck Juma, what are you expecting? Schindler's List, you know? So.
I love the ad for it. How does that go? That there are movies that are made that are, you know, that have great aspirations and that sort of thing. This is not one of those films.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We're open up front. I mean, even when we did The God Complex on the video box, I think it says official rejection of 10 prestigious film festivals or something like that. So, you know, a lot of the time you look at these and you just go, you know, you make it for the target audience. It's not mainstream by any stretch of the imagination. But if you can please that small group of people that get the joke, then, you know, the job is done.
Well, you know, that's the other thing too. You know, there are a lot of quote stupid comedies out there, but you are a stupid comedy that's smart.
No, seriously, I
really believe that. And there's a lot of thought that goes into the comedy that I see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that has always made me like your work.
But you see, and I think that it takes a certain intellect to get that, because there are some people that can look at South Park or Family Guy and not see past the language or the crudity. But then there's others that can see the absolute genius behind some of the bits. I mean, South Park, which I kind of look at that as one of the best things ever on television, because, you know, they're so up to date, you know, and Family Guy, same thing. But I know people that, oh, they're just a bunch of poor kids and they just swear and tell poop jokes and that. Yeah, but look beyond that and you'll find the nuggets, you know, and I don't mean that as a pun, but I think that there's so many things that, you know, people can sometimes hear comedy in a small range, and then if you go out of that range, it becomes almost offensive to people, or they just don't get it. And if they don't get it, then they're going to say, oh, that wasn't funny. But comedy is very personal. You know, what makes one person laugh may not make another person laugh. And, you know, I never found shows like Friends all that funny, but it's a popular show, or it was. So, you know, it's just a matter of what appeals to people.
I have to agree with you there. I even tried to rewatch Friends recently, like I, because I was hearing all this, you know, hubbub about it, and so I rewatched it. Like I forced myself through it, and holy shit, it's worse the second time. It is not funny at all. It's just depressing and weird.
You know, there's, I'm telling you, there are people that look at that and think it's hysterical. It's like the original Seinfeld, which I always thought Curb Your Enthusiasm is a much funnier show because they've taken the reins off. You know, Seinfeld had to stay within a certain range, and they could get edgy a little bit, but they always had to dance the line. But a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is kind of like Seinfeld on steroids, is, to me, I think a much, much superior show. And again, because you're not held back for, you know, any kind of restrictions.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you very, very much for being on with us. Why don't you give a little bit of a plug on Paramount and everything so people know where to watch your films and what films you recommend and such.
Well, okay. I think the easiest thing for you to do is just go to Tubi TV and type in my name, Mark Pirro, in their search window, and you'll get about at least 6 or 7 of my films, so you can see them all there. If you want to look at them in order, you know, you could start with Polish Vampire and work your way up through Queer Wolf, Death Row Game Show, Rage of Innocence, Celluloid Soul, Colorblinded, I think is up there too. So you've got all these movies to choose from. And at the risk of getting delete it again, you can get the Submissive Jesus Prayer Answering Talking Head by going to www.thesubmissivejesus.com. Order yours today. We can autograph it for you. So I think that's about it.
You're going to get 2 orders today. I'm going there as soon as we get off the phone. By the way, one other thing I should mention. Are you familiar with a director by the name of Joe Badon?
Joe Badon. I don't know the name. Maybe I've heard of some of his work.
Okay, so his latest film was Sister Tempest. And Joe is a friend of the podcast. But he has some of the same energy that you do, only he does it more in terms of really, I call him the micro-budget Jodorowsky. Yeah, seriously. It's someone you should mention, but the reason I mentioned it is I got in Sister Tempest, he has an astronaut, so I got a toy astronaut. So I'm going to put the Submissive Jesus right next to the toy astronaut, and they're going to have a conversation.
There you go, and then when we're both dead, you got things you can sell on eBay.
Or if I'm dead, I'll send them back to you. No problem.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right.
Well,
so anything
I only
else,
collect
Mark?
Things I like. So.
Cool.
Well, there you go. That means you're not going to have an astronaut. Oh, well.
No, I'm saying I collect things I like, meaning they'll never be sold after you guys die. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I collect things because I want them. I like my shinies.
Oh, I see. Well, that's why you got to get a bunch of the Jesus heads, you know, and just put them all over your house.
I could probably do that. Start just, like, sneaking them into random people's houses, like my neighbors, you know, just go over there one day and drop off.
Yeah, they make great Christmas gifts, great Easter gifts. In fact, bring them to church.
Well, see, I was thinking, you know, it's just like one day they open a cabinet that they don't usually use, and suddenly there's a Submissive Jesus there. Yeah, that could be a thing.
That would do it. That would change somebody's religion fast.
By the way, I don't know if you know this, Mark, but I'm actually a church musician and also have a master's in church music. So maybe I'll get two and put one in my Christian Science church that I play for. How's that?
Oh, definitely. Are you kidding me? You'd be the most popular person there if they don't hang you or crucify you or whatever they do these days.
Yeah, more or less. More or less. All right. So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping. First off, Rachel, what is the Steven number today?
We're at -1 today on the Steven count.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll explain that later, okay? But we're going to be giving you a Stephen count from here on in on our podcast. Okay, so
absolutely.
As far as upcoming shows, so here we go. On Thursday, we're going to have director Trent Harris on, and he has a new film, which is basically a sequel to Reuben and Ed, which is his film that he did in the 90s with Crispin Glover and Karen Black, and it's called Echo People. And also on the show, we're going to have Sam Lesson with us, who knows Trent quite well and actually was on the previous podcast that we had with Trent. Okay, then on Friday, we have Adam, and he's going to be doing the Cathode Ray Mission. We're going to have an episode on the West Wing. And on Saturday, Rachel, tell us what we're going to do on our commentary watch.
Oh, my gosh. So this is a really sad moment in history. And if you don't know who this guy is, you probably really suck at watching movies. But Sonny Chiba passed away a few days ago. What was it? Last week. And that was really, really disappointing for a lot of us in the film world. So Saturday, we decided to commemorate Sonny Chiba. And instead of just doing a whole show about him, you have to see this guy in action. So we're not going to do a talk cast. We're going to do a commentary watch on one of his greatest films, The Bodyguard. Yes.
And it's
joining
not
us.
One with Whitney Houston, okay? Not with Houston.
No, and I am super, super stoked to be able to announce that joining us for this commentary watch, the rarely seen Doc is going to crawl out of his little cave and out from under his rock, and he's going to be on the commentary with us. So I'm holding him to it now that I've announced it on the air.
Okay. And one other announcement that we have to make is that, A, Deviant Legion is now officially on Twitter. Not a huge Twitter presence yet, but that will change. As in the near future, we are going to be much more accessible to everyone. We are working on that. And I would say within the month, there will be major, major announcements about where we're going and what we're doing. But we also want to thank a lot of people that's come on board. One would be Sydney DeSino. Another one would be John Killian. But with a number of people, just like you were talking about, Mark, you know, you have family that help you, and we've gotten all these people to come in and really support where we want to go. So there
well,
are major changes.
I do want to announce two more people that we should. Oh.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Rachel.
I was going to say there's two more people that we needed to thank. We recently got Mika Davis back with the Deviant Legion, so we're happy to welcome her home. She's going to start doing some more stuff with us, I think a lot with the Cathode Ray Mission and stuff. We're going to be doing an episode on the show Them here in the future. It's going to be awesome. And also we have a new designer in our group, Josh.
Yes.
We want to say thanks to him as well. He's done some – yes, I didn't know if he wanted me to say his last name or not. So Josh Buckland, we have to thank him too. He's done a lot of behind-the-scenes work for us that's been very much appreciated.
Absolutely. Again, Mark, I want to thank you very, very much for being on. Any last words?
Last words, probably, I'm dead.
That's perfect. That's
thank
perfect.
You,
Mark, thank you so much. Rachel, anything before we head off into the wild blue?
No, I think I'm all good there.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Mark, for being on with us. And we will see you on Thursday, and that is at 5 o'clock Eastern time in the afternoon with Trent Harris. So we'll see you on Thursday, and thank you very much for being on. Good night, everyone.
Night.
We done?
Here we go.